WPFW Washington presents Dialogue with Dorothy Healy. For the next hour, join Dorothy and her guests as they discuss the issues and concerns of our nation. And now, here is your host.
Good morning, WPFW in Washington, D.C. This is Dialogue with Dorothy and Richard Healy. You may by now be expecting that you may realize this is not Richard or Dorothy Healy. My name is Rob Robinson. I was drafted in to sit in for Richard, who is on vacation today. I'm going to be interviewing today a young author, Donald Earl Collins, who is the author Fear of a Black America. Donald, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Rob.
Donald, why don't you tell us what prompted you to write a book with such a provocative title?
Public Enemy, for starters. You know, the title's based on their 1990 album, Fear of a Black Planet. So, but within that album and within that title is the whole idea of how we understand multiculturalism in this country and how during the 1990s and even today, how many of us are fearful of the idea of this country no longer having sort of whiteness as its standard for culture and rather having a variety of cultures being the standard, most prominently, of course, African-American culture.
Is it safe to say that you did believe that they were into something with the song title, that there is fear of a black planet, but your book is an attempt to perhaps broaden and deepen the perspective on what that fear is really all about?
Exactly.
Well, first of all, why don't you tell us, expand a little bit on the notion that the complexion of the United States is changing, and as that happens, people begin to have qualms about what that means for the national identity. Why don't you explain that generally, and then let's talk about how that affects specific groups of people.
Well, fact of the matter is that over the last quarter century or so, the United States has become increasingly non-white. There are far more people of color in this country now than there were a generation or two ago. 25% of the population alone is either black or brown, African-American, Latino. In addition to that, that's only on the increase. Certainly the statistics say that by mid-century, somewhere in the neighborhood of half the population will be non-white. So we have an increasingly multicultural society, but not necessarily a multiculturalist society, a society that believes in the idea of being multicultural, of embracing and accepting and acknowledging the existence even of other cultures and subcultures and how that has contributed to the development of our country to this point and should, in fact, contribute to the development of our nation in the future.
We've, Donald, it seems to me that this is an issue that we've been in denial about a long time. I mean, after all, the country was originally not a white country to begin with. And as soon as white people came to this country, not only did they begin the subjugation of the Native American people, but they brought people over from Africa and other parts of the world to do work for them. So the country has never been a white country per se.
Well, that's absolutely true.
So part of the fear taps into the fact that there's been that suppression of the acknowledgement of our true history.
Right. And that's absolutely true. One of the first things I say in the book is that this country's been multicultural ever since African Americans, whites, and Native Americans began to mingle, and that's roughly 400 years ago. So in point of fact, part of my premise is that we've always been multicultural. There have always been other groups in this country who have contributed to our development, economic development, political development, social development, cultural development, and so on. It's only been in the last quarter century that it's just barely begun to get acknowledged. And even with all that acknowledgement, there's certainly not full acceptance of that. There's certainly not an embracing of that, of really wanting to know what's behind the black box of blackness or the black box of Latino-ness and so on.
So could we talk a little bit, Donald, about how this fear, how this denial of the multiculti aspect of this country works? Because certainly there are a lot of people, black and white, that are in denial about the fact that this is not a monolingual country. So could you talk a little bit about how this fear affects different groups? Because we all have ignorance. We all have fear of the unknown, you know, the worries about otherness to some extent.
Well, you have to define what fear is, first of all. And I use you know, I kind of take the spiritual definition of fear, which is the absence of faith, and expand on that quite a bit, meaning that we're not just talking about people who are scared of the unknown. We're talking about people who are skeptical about the realities of our multicultural America. That is to say that whether we're talking African Americans or whites or Latinos or any other group or subgroup or even an individual, that fundamentally that there's a certain sense of skepticism or doubt that as a result of our transformation, our gradual transformation to a society that is at least acknowledging the existence and the contributions of others and other cultures, that there's skepticism that the society as we know it will survive. And not only in terms of as we know it, but what will it look like? When all the transformations take place, what will our society look like by mid-century? Will mm-hmm. we even have an America that is comfortable for whites to be in, comfortable for African Americans to be in, comfortable for all of us to live in? So that's in large part what I talk about in Fear of a Black America. I also talk about this notion of cultural equality and how it relates to fear, because fundamentally that's what multiculturalism is. So if you take this 16-letter, 7-syllable word and really break it down, that's all we're talking about, is the equality of other cultures in terms of the American tapestry as a whole. And so when you think about the fear, you're also talking about the fear that not only the fear of what the society is going to look like, you're also talking about the fear of whites pretty much from a white perspective, and this is very broad brush, I'm not, you know, particularly white conservatives, where there's a fear that they're going to lose power. They're going to lose political power. They're going to lose economic power. There's going to be a loss in status.
They're going to lose privilege.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very tough. But Donald, you're a young man. You're obviously well-educated. How, as someone coming through college, how did multiculturalism grasp you? You must have had a sense of being alienated in a lot of ways from a lot of the status quos.
Well, I think I think that my entire life has lent itself to multiculturalism. Obviously, if someone were to look at me, 6'3", 35 years old, weigh approximately 215 pounds, I'm a big black man, basically. But at the same time, I'm a black person who's experienced other cultures. For better or for worse, I grew up for 3 years as a Hebrew Israelite, which roughly translated means I was a black Jew for 3 years.
Here in the United States or in North Africa or in Israel?
Mount Vernon, New York, suburban New York City.
Whoa.
During that time period, my mom and my now ex-stepfather decided that this was the spiritual direction we ought to go in.
Okay.
So I became a student of Orthodox Judaism for 3 years.
Now, how old were you when this was happening?
Between the ages of 11 and 14.
Oh, okay. So were you bar mitzvahed?
Luckily, no. I managed to miss that.
Because I would have had to have completely different music for the show if that was the case. The engineer is blanching. He's looking around for his klezmer CDs. I'm sorry, Donald.
It's okay. The fact of the matter is that having that exposure while simultaneously living in suburban America, simultaneously being in a gifted and talented track program where the majority of students were affluent whites and affluent Jews, at the same time going through this spiritual sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, this spiritual quagmire, because it confused me for 3 years, obvious, for a variety of reasons, until I decided to become a Christian, which for me was
a big move.
Not only a big move, but the path which I should have gone in the first place. Okay. But with all of that came an awareness that I'm not normal. I'm not a normal person, and there's no such thing as a normal life on top of that. And it awakened in me the wanting to know about what, having an understanding of what's going on. And in the world of affluent whites in suburbia, and the world of Jews in New York City, and the world of Hasidic Jews, for that matter, wanting to understand what Hebrew Israelite, being a Hebrew Israelite, was versus being part of the Nation of Islam, versus being a Christian, versus being a denominational Christian, and so on. You get the picture. I mean, the fact of the matter is that by the time I was 14, I already had a multiculturalist frame of mind. So that by the time I got to college, by the time I finished my bachelor's degree and began graduate school, when multiculturalism became a hot topic mm-hmm. in the early 90s, I already had an interest in it.
Well, we're going to come back and hear Chapter 2 of Donald Earl Collins and Fear of a Black America. But in the meantime, we're going to take a little musical break with one of the premier multicultural bands in this country, Brooklyn Funk Essentials. And we're either going to hear The Creator Has a Master Plan, or we're going to hear something about the revolution. Brooklyn Funk Essentials. Take it away, Andy.
The revolution was postponed because of rain. The underlying immediate political, socio-economic and trigger mechanism causes were all in place when some Negro or the other got hungry, had to stop at the McDonald's, had to get on the line with a new trainee cashier. Where's the button for the fries? So we missed the bus. Then the leader couldn't find his keys. Didn't want some poor ass moving his brand new 20-inch and VCR out his living room on the shoulders. It was too late when the locksmith came. Then our demo expert, Willie Blue, got arrested. Came out with his head hanging onto his hoodie. Didn't know they started doing that for jumping the turnstiles, he said. How many times must we tell you? Don't get caught. We voted against shooting him on the spot. In the winter we were all depressed, so we leaned our guns up against the sofas and listened instead to Tim Tim Tree singing about his dysfunctions. He sang, sometimes I wonder if I'll ever be free, free of the sins of my brutish daddy, like the cheating, the stealing, the drinking, and the beating. The weatherman said the 17th would be sunshine and it wouldn't be too hot. Tim Tim Tree doesn't like sweating. But that night the weatherman came on crying, saying he didn't control the weather, that God was real, that he's lucky he God didn't strike him, the weatherman, with lightning for taking the credit sometimes, and that he, the weatherman, was in no way responsible for the hurricane coming, and that we, the viewers, should pray Jesus into our heart before it was too late. Super Bowl Sunday was out. All the women wanted to see the game, and the men were pissed at their insensitivity. The 20th was supposed to be a definite. We looked for some that steals the storm, didn't find any. Settled on the armory instead before they moved the homeless in. We'll bum rush it anyway, I said. It smells like a collection of 1,000 farts in there, they said. So we waited for the approval of the city contract to build a Bastille, which set the revolution back 5 years. Start a revolution on Tuesday. She was in a pissed off mood. Her tax return didn't come in time for the rent. But they showed the We Are the World video on cable that evening, and we all held hands and cried to stop from laughing, and our anger subsided. Looking
back, it could have been. And we're back. That was Brooklyn Funk Essentials. I am speaking this morning with Donald Earl Collins, author of Fear of a Black America. And Dr. Collins is talking to us a little bit about what multiculturalism really means. And he just explained to us that he came from a black Israelite background, which is the way he was raised as a young person, and then became a Christian. Donald, why don't you tell us, when you decided to write the book to let people know, give them a better sense of what the cultural essence of this country really is, and I would imagine the extent to which it is not monolithic, that it is a multiply patterned fabric. Tell us what some of the key themes in this book are, so that people can run out and buy this and begin learning from your example.
Well, the book is essentially a critique. It's a critique of how African Americans have and whites and other groups in this country have understood multiculturalism. Because fundamentally, when it's reported in the media, when it's talked about at conferences, when you see it talked about by governors who say multiculturalism is bunk, like my governor in Maryland, for instance.
That would be Governor Ehrlich?
Yes. The whole notion of multiculturalism just becomes food, folks, and fun. You know, let's dance to something that's multicultural. Let's go eat at Taco Bell. Let's
sushi on Thursday.
Exactly.
Yeah, Caribbean on Friday.
It's all superficial. It's all surface. And the whole idea of writing the book is really to uncover the what's beneath the surface on multiculturalism, at least with regard to African Americans. You know, using African Americans as an example, I talk about the whole notion that African Americans are far from monolithic. They're within that whole group category. You're talking about a form of multiculturalism that deals directly with the issue of race, but also deals with issues of class and gender, religion, and so on and so forth. And point of fact, talking about that, while at the same time talking about how certain themes have dominated African-American culture over the course of the 20th century, whether it's the theme of integration and desegregation, or it's the theme of hip-hop is over the last, say, quarter century, and so on and so forth.
As in, hip-hop has been kind of like a cultural wave that has impacted and changed the notion of American culture.
Right. Absolutely. So. You know, talking about African Americans by themselves, you're dealing with the whole issue of multiculturalism. But when you throw in other groups, when you throw in mainstream America, when you throw in white America, then it becomes even more complicated. Because of course, whites aren't monolithic either. They certainly have monolithic they have multiple points of view. Even conservatives have multiple points of view. It's just that most of their views on multiculturalism tend to run into this whole issue of fear, which is the major theme of the book. How, on the one hand, you've got progressives, African Americans, other people of color, who are, in fact, trying to promote, embrace, push the whole notion that our cultures have contributed to American society, while you have, on the other hand, white conservatives who have pushed against that. They have tried to do everything from repress to actually ignore and exclude, and now to basically just make multiculturalism this sort of negative, evil, it's going to destroy America kind of thing.
How's it going to destroy America?
Well, as one author...
You mean we're all going to become brown and...
Well, that might be some of their fears, but I don't think that's the way most of the scholars explain it. For someone like author Schlesinger, for instance, who wrote Disuniting of America in 1992, it would destroy America simply because of the fact that by multiculturalism being promoted with the smoke, it's a smokescreen, he says. Multiculturalism really isn't multiculturalism, it's Afrocentricity. And since it relates predominantly to African Americans, the whole idea around multiculturalism really is just a promotion of African American culture. It will destroy America because, of course, African American culture really doesn't have anything to offer America. That's essentially the argument that he makes in the scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. William Bennett, former drug czar, former Secretary of Education under Reagan,
sitting at the blackjack tables in Las Vegas.
Yeah, his argument is that multiculturalism is a virus targeted to attack American culture as a whole, and in this case, American culture is highbrow American culture, which presumably is white American culture, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant American culture, and that the common culture has to destroy this immunological agent before we're destroyed by it. So they see anything that's linked to blackness as essentially being something that is evil. They don't explain why it's evil in any major detail. They just say that it is.
Well, is there any notion for why it's evil? Because if you look at the cultural contributions of African Americans to literature, to art, to academics, to certainly to the moral leadership of this country, you have to be crazy to believe that African Americans have not made a significant contribution to American culture. In fact, when you think about what's the predominant white manifestation of American popular culture, you tend to think about commercial stuff, you know, like fast food or certain types of movies. When you think of culture in terms of music, you think of jazz, you know, poetry, so on and so forth, you definitely are getting into the African Americans, you know, spirit. And when you think of popular entertainment, how can you not find African Americans and American popular entertainment in the 20th century or the 21st century? You can't. So a lot of this is just ignorance.
Well, that's part of it. But part of it's also, like I said earlier, we're talking about issues of privilege and power.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. I mean, we've got a Supreme Court nominee right now. Someone from a wealthy family went to Harvard. His father was a wealthy steel executive. We keep hearing that the Supreme Court is being packed to promote conservative views. It seems to me that it's being packed more to protect the privilege of rich white people.
Well, that's what the Supreme Court's always done. Let's face facts. If you want to talk about the entire history of the Supreme Court since 1789, there have only been very brief periods where the Supreme Court has swung the pendulum from conservatism to liberalism. The 1860s and 70s, the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, for instance. For the most part, it's a moderate to conservative bellwether in general. So Roberts is nothing new. I mean, occasionally you get a Supreme Court justice that completely surprises people, like Earl Warren, for instance. Mm-hmm. But he's the exception that proves the rule. Most people who are using courts as a form of social change never make it far enough to even be considered as a Supreme Court justice nominee.
Okay, well, we're speaking with Donald Earl Collins about his book, Fear of a Black America, and he's certainly got a lot of interesting insights. We're going to take another short break, musical break, with the Brooklyn Funk Essentials. When we come back, we're going to ask our listeners to call in and place their questions before Mr. Collins. The call-in phone number, listeners, is 202-588-0893, but we're going to go out with a little musical break, and it's Brooklyn Funk Essentials one more time.
This fucker's 9 minutes long?
Yeah, just long enough to blow your brains out.
And we're back on Dialogue with Dorothy and Richard Healy. I'm Rob Robinson. I'm sitting in for Richard Healy. As many of you know, Dorothy has been ill recently, so keep the cards and letters coming. We're speaking with author Donald Earl Collins, author of Fear of a Black America, and we have two callers that have questions to put to Mr. Collins. Caller number one, thank you so much for calling this morning. What is your name and what is your question?
My name is James, and I'm listening to this. I mean, first of all, I'm African-American. I don't even know where to begin here. I mean, this is just propaganda I'm hearing on the radio here. It's not the fact that white people are afraid of multiculturalism. What they see is whenever it hits, it basically means you got to dumb things down. You look at the SAT, the ACT scores, basically the black people say, well, these are racially biased toward white students. What they're really saying is, we're too dumb to pass the test. And, you know, that's the way it usually works. And whatever, if you can name another country in the world where, you know, where multiculturalism took over and then the economy didn't decline and society didn't decline, it never happens. It always goes down. That's why Japan, I think the Prime Minister of Japan said about 10 years ago, he says, your reason your country is having so many economic problems is you have too many black people in your country.
I'm not sure that we're clear on what point you're making, James.
My point is this. Whenever multiculturalism comes in, it usually means a decline in the standards of the country.
You want to take a swing at that, Donald?
There are only a few countries in which even the notion of multiculturalism has taken a hold in public policy. I mean, Japan's certainly not one of them. I would, you know, Canada certainly is one. Great Britain certainly another. And in point of fact, I don't think either country is in the midst of some serious cultural decline. But I don't really even know how to begin to answer the question of the propaganda that I'm supposedly been talking about for the past half hour.
Well, maybe we'll hear from someone else. We have another caller on the line. Caller, thank you. What is your question for Donald Collins? Good morning. Caller. Good morning. Thank you for calling in. Yes. What's your name and what's your question for Dr. Collins?
Yes, my name is Harold, and my question for Dr. Collins is that as far as the title of his book, Multiculturalism and Blacks in America, I'm a little surprised that he's using the term African America simultaneous with blacks. If you're talking multiculturalism, you've got to acknowledge the fact that there are many blacks in the U.S. that are not from Africa, and they may be from the Caribbean, or if they are from Africa, they're not typically considered African-American. So I believe, you know, it would be better to just use black as an identifier rather than using the term African-American.
I actually explained this explicitly at the very beginning of the book, that I deliberately interchange African-American with black for the simple reason that that's what's used in this country. If you're going to talk about a person of African descent born in the United States, then they're either considered black or they're African-American. And I actually also deliberately don't use the hyphen in African-American for a variety of reasons. Some are political and some just because it makes it easier to use it as a literary device. But if I were talking specifically about those of African descent originally from the Caribbean, or those are African descent who are from the Caribbean who live in the U.S., then I would simply use the term Afro-Caribbean or Black Caribbean. I'm very deliberate in terms of the terms I actually do use in the book and in general around this issue.
Okay, we have a number of callers on the line. We definitely tapped into a thread. Caller, please give us your name and tell us what your question is for Dr. Collins.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is R.G., and your conversation early on sort of conjured up and struck up thoughts and visions and inner sounds of klezmer and Hasidic music with a mix and a twist to it. But I don't know if matzah and pork chops or knishes and hambits actually work well together, if you know what I mean.
Straighten us out then, R.G., straighten us out.
Strangely enough, it's rather timely that this conversation arises at a time when we're witnessing a sort of a mass exodus from Gaza in the Israeli homeland, and that during an attempt last night to control a paper snafu in my residence, I ran across my Hillel magazine and my Star of David that I made for an art class and a few other things, so the plot thickens. But more specifically and more seriously, Jews in policy, in public policy and mass media, and Jews and finances, monetary system, their control over it, which has been traditional through the ages. An excellent expose of that done by Abba Iban and on a PBS called Legacy, I think it was, and the Jews and how their history came down through and tied into Western civilization. But the thing is that you spoke about being a Hebrew Israelite. Now, to my knowledge, I don't know if your study of that was, and it's, obviously it was Orthodox, but to my knowledge, there was a sect or a an arm of that organization that was more or less deemed to believe that the black man was the first Jew. And as well, what is your spin on Jewish miscegenation and racism? How it, you know, it's still there, even though we haven't dealt with our own problems. I mean, we can cue the banks and places of, you know, Metro and all this, but we haven't solved our own problems, and we've got people here that we're talking about Homeland Security.
Let me
I mean, I'm jumping around, but I wanted to, you know, we haven't dealt with our own problems in the United States, and you know, we have to follow that.
Yeah, I understand. I think I understand what your question is. I think the first thing that you have to do is kind of separate this whole issue of, I mean, part of the problem when we talk about this whole issue of multiculturalism is the whole issue of who's to blame. Who, I mean, are Jews to blame? Are African Americans to blame? Are whites to blame for some of the...
Well, you want to remove the fear, first of all.
Yeah.
And you want people to understand that there's more multiplicity there than we tend to acknowledge.
Right. And in point of fact, you know, we're all to blame. we have some degree of blame to take for the situation regarding the racial rift valley that we face in this country today.
Okay. We have lots of people on the phone, so we want to take the next caller. Caller, please give us your name and tell us, if you can, in as few words as possible, what your question is for Donald Collins.
My name is Mike, and Donald, I think I heard you on Ambrose RLA. I enjoyed that conversation as well.
Thank you.
My question to you is, I forget the writer's name, but he wrote, is Bill Cosby right?
And Michael Eric Dyson?
Michael Eric Dyson. Okay. Thank you. And I see a lot of echoes of what you're saying in Michael Dyson's book, because you're talking about, like, this is the reality, and this is who we are, and this is the fear. Because I think what both of you are writing about, maybe my question is a comparison, is that there's a code, there's an unofficial code that people know what you're talking about without them saying it. Like what Arthur Schlesinger said, it's just bad. Like people say you live in a good neighborhood, it implies that you live in a white neighborhood. I go to a good school, that implies it's a predominantly white school or private school. And it's a way of signaling, and I think what upsets people is that you're messing up that neatness. As much as people want to talk about political correctness, they don't mind political correctness as long as you don't take away their codes, as long as they can say the same things. What do you think about that, the way we dance around race and politics in our life? And
well,
the prior caller that called about the standards going down.
Right.
I had decent SAT scores, and I graduated very high in my class. And there were people that had very poor scores that got into schools that graduated below me. So I don't know what the hell he's talking about. I think he should read the book, The Invisible Man. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. To answer your question, I think that when you talk about the whole issue of, when you talk about the whole issue of multiculturalism, and you talk about sort of the different, you know, the different perspectives that people take, where you're talking about Dyson or even talking about myself, I think the thing that you have to understand is, yes, I mean, the whole part of what we're doing is trying to upset the apple cart, trying to move us away from the status quo of of alleged colorblindness in America today, trying to move us away from this notion that race is this social, is an acceptable social construct, when in point of fact, everything that we see in our culture today contradicts that, at least in our popular culture. The problem is moving from popular culture to highbrow mainstream culture, the whole idea that that we need to blur these lines. These lines need to be blurred if we're going to survive as a society for the long term.
But as you point out, even highly educated people like Arthur Schlesinger can be prisoners of their own ignorance of different cultures and different races in this country. Most of us in this country are raised within a very narrow social economic track. And if we don't go out of that track, we're never going to overcome the racism and the prejudices that we're brought up with, regardless of what our religion is, our income is, or what our race is. So one of the messages that you're bringing to people is, if you want to get out of the fear and if you want to get out of the ignorance, you've got to live your way out of it. You can't just write books about it and read books about it. You've got to get out in the street and meet people you don't know. We have many more callers on the line. Caller, please give us your name and your question for Donald Earl Collins.
Yes, good morning. My name is Eric, and I'm calling to speak with Dr. Collins on some of the issues he's raised. Every issue he's raised has been an important issue. And with the research I've done over the course of my life, I'm 56 years old, and I have been drawn to this understanding since it was a brand new understanding from the readings and teachings of Noble Drew Ali, Elijah Poole when he became Elijah Muhammad, and those who researched with, studied with, and taught from those understandings. There's too many things for me to say in one comment. First, the comment about the Hebrew Israelites. Now, I understand that the Hebrew Israelites are historical. I am convinced with the research I've done that the term Jew, referring to a person from a descendant or a direct member of the tribe of Judah, with the research I've done, is not a religious but a racial identifier. I would love to make a ton of comments. I will just leave a few points. I would like for Dr. Collins to research the history as much as he can of African-Americans, African-American ancestry before they were identified as African-Americans. Between the time of 70 A.D. and the time of the Portuguese and Dutch exporting of slaves, I would like to be make this point about racial identity and cultural identity. As a people, we have got to understand that we are devoid of any true cultural identity. The definition and psychological implications of slavery negate that. Colonization is a different point and a different set of psychological restrictions on a person. We have adapted so-called, quote, black understandings since we begin to hold in group realization that they actually are a set of understandings unique to African Americans. Mr. Schlesinger's book and the other gentleman he quoted, William Bennett, when they talk about fear, they are talking about a fear on many levels. Another point, when we talk about black cultural understanding, all black cultural understanding has been influenced. Another point, there has been no way that we as a people have been able to clearly express an understanding since we as a people historically have never held to a clear understanding. I just want to make those points. You may discuss them, debate them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'm going to address your first point because I think it's the most important point you make. I mean, the fact of the matter is all we've been talking about is the reality that we're all different and yet the same at the same time. So that's one thing to point to talk about in terms of your points. So you're right about that in terms of talking about cultural diversity, the cultural diversity of African Americans. Discovery Channel actually did a special, I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 years ago, about the legacy of the lost tribes of Israel, tracing those 10 lost tribes, because in point of fact, you know, by through enslavement by the Assyrians and the Persians, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 BC, of the 12 original tribes of Israel, 10 of them ended up scattering.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Discovery Channel special, if I remember correctly, traced some of those descendants to places such as Southern Africa and South Asia, using genetic evidence, mm-hmm. DNA material. Of course, this is controversial, but the special is out there. So if you really want to do this whole research about, you know, is there African in the Israelite, so to speak, question, then there's your, you know, there's part of your answer. Someone's actually already done the work.
if it comes to whether or not there's Africanness, I mean, everybody is a brother from way back if you go way back and far enough.
Right. There's a what they call a scientific Adam that can be traced about 60,000 years BC.
Yeah.
That
was an African.
It's from Southern Africa. So
deal with it. Okay, we have more callers, though. Next caller, what's your name and what's your question?
Oh, how are you today? My name is Michael.
Michael, thank you.
And my quick question, and I'll make a quick comment.
Thank you.
A lot of people, the last two callers covered all my comments, actually. my quick question is, what is the name of your book again?
Fear of a Black America. The full title is Fear of a Black America, Multiculturalism and the African American Experience.
Okay, I'll find that. And my quick comment, if I may, is, maybe it's just me, but now my ancestry is African. The indigenous people here, people of First Nation, also called Indians, which is a mistake for several hundred years, but anyway, and Irish. Of that, I pretty much go with the African-American or black guy because that's how people see me. Now, I just say that just to get past that. I recognize what you just said is true for me. We're all brothers. That's the way I believe, and I couldn't care less what other people think. I treat everyone with respect. I'm 52 years old. Yes, a black man from Washington, D.C., living a glorious life because I choose to. Now, finally, I understand there are all kinds of isms and schisms and this and that happening to people. I came through segregation, all that kind of stuff. I understand that how that happened. Why, I'm not sure, but I understand that it happened. So in closing, I'm okay. I'm fine. I'm going to read your book, and thank you very much. Keep doing what you're doing. Have a good day.
While the next caller is warming up, why don't you let people know where they can get your book?
You can get the book at Politics and Prose. They carry it. Also, you can order the book online at any of the major book websites like Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and so on.
Next caller, please give us your name and your question for Donald Earl Collins, author of Fear of a Black America. Caller?
Hi, my name is Alan, and my favorite T-shirt says, I used to be a white American, but I gave it up in the interest of humanity, and I welcome the idea. I think that's the reason that so many, I mean, a lot of white people have to confront their racism in dealing with multiculturalism because they're so afraid that their little precious white identity is going to be absorbed into something. Instead of that, they should look at this as a chance to be merging cultures. I mean, Coltrane used to watch Marx Brothers movies just so he could see Harpo play the harp. And they're dozens and dozens of examples of multiculturalism, of people like embracing one another's different cultures. It's, you know, the idea of multiculturalism shouldn't be frightening to those people who are like seeking liberation. That's all I got to say.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you so much. Next caller, please give us your name and your question for Dr. Collins.
My name is John, and I just heard excerpts of your program, but it made me think of James Baldwin, who said, as long as you call yourself white, I will call myself black. Now, the British have decided to take over the American system of racial identity. They're going to start with Afro-British or whatever. If white people, and I agree with the previous caller, would stop because they were not white until they passed the Statue of Liberty, if they would stop, if they would stop calling themselves white, there would be no need for all of this. James Baldwin was right. Tell them to stop calling themselves white.
Well, if it were that simple,
good plan.
Yeah, it's a good plan. But but it's not just calling themselves white. It's what all that connotates.
All the stuff that goes with it.
Yeah, everything that goes with it.
But that's a great point. Thank you so much, caller. Next caller, please give us your name and your question for Dr. Collins.
Good morning. My name is Yvonne, And I'm calling to find out whether in your book you go into white skin privilege and how this blocks out awareness of all cultures of color around the world, and that Africa is not one nation. It is composed of over 53 nations, the African continent. Yet the people of Africa, supposedly because they look like black people in America, are all referred to as African people, and only the negative images from Africa and the negative images from the African communities are portrayed in the news. This is particularly important to me, this last part, because I feel that it conditions and conspires to make sure that white skin privilege remains that which is an economic social condition, white skin privilege. It makes sure, through the underpayment of people who are of color, that they have a very difficult time attaining the same status and therefore live in ghettos, et cetera, or the image of the poor black person is the only one that is portrayed. So white skin privilege is impacted in all of these, and I'd like to know how you address it in your book. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. I do address it. I address it through, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, who's the first scholar to actually even really talk about whiteness and how there are psychological and physical wages of whiteness in his book Black Reconstruction from 1935. But in talking about white privilege and talking about white skin privilege and things of that nature, it's important not just to talk about the whole notion of what that is, because I think anybody of color and even most progressives understand that notion. It's where we're going with it. It's the question. What's this going to look like as the 21st century continues? Fact of the matter, I mean, that's one of the things I talk about in the book, is the whole idea of where all of this is going. I think that fundamentally what the question becomes here is that as economic pressures, as other pressures take, cultural pressures, the pressures of war and so on, have taken their hold on our society in the early 21st century, how much weight does white skin privilege still have? It still has a lot of weight. But my question is, which I don't fully answer in the book, is how does that look over the course of the 21st century as other notions of ness, blackness, and so on have taken a more dominant hold on American culture in general?
All right, well, we still have a number of callers on the line. Next caller, could you please give us your name and state your question for Dr. Collins, please?
Yes, sir. Good morning. How you doing? Hello?
Hey, how you doing?
My name is Bill. Yes, sir. I would like to explore this thing about multiculturalism. It's a difference, I think, in the late 80s and early 90s. It was pushed by the media and by the government, multiculturalism, that is. I feel that if you're a black person in America, you're already multicultural. You're wearing somebody else's name. You're speaking somebody else's language. And basically, somebody else's culture was forced on you, different than your own.
Right.
But I think it's a playoff when you say multiculturalism. When people say it and don't practice it, that's always been America. They say this is a melting pot for everybody, but the only culture that is pushed is basically European culture. So my question is to the gentleman there, how can you be multiculturalism in a white supremacy system if the only culture that's promoted is European culture? And well, you have a whole bunch of other people. Another thing is that if you have the makeup of the country is different, and politically people of color going to vote one way and those other people going to vote another way, you're going to have a conflict there. The rulers are going to be white in the country, which it is, and the population is going to be basically people of color. And I'd like to know, how would you solve that conflict and that problem? Thank you, sir.
Wow. I'm going
to you could be president. Solve that conflict.
That's exactly the point of the book. The point of the book is that we are a multicultural society that refuses to practice multiculturalism in general. And point of fact that to solve that problem, the simple answer is, of course, we embrace the fact that we have all these cultural differences that makes us who we are as Americans, right? But obviously that's not simple when embracing that, there's this, you know, as I've said before, there's this notion, this fear that if we fully embrace it, whites lose power in American society. So of course, conservatives, people who are concerned with these kinds of issues, will smokescreen multiculturalism to make it mean anything other than what it actually means. Whether it just means being black, whether it means Afrocentricity, whether it means, you know. And by the way, multiculturalism, if you're going to go by the strict definition of it, does in fact include whites as well, because you know they're not on a pedestal and under the notion of multiculturalism. So of course, there's even more fear as a result of that. So. To solve the problem,
multiculturalism is just riding on the bus with everybody else.
Yeah, or the metro, as the case may be. So, in point of fact, in order to solve that problem, you have to, you know, you have to, in order to be part of the solution, you have to simply say, you know what, it doesn't matter if this is a white supremacist society. I'm still going to embrace. I'm going to be empathetic towards others. I'm going to embrace other cultures. I'm going to want to learn another language because, in point of fact, in order for me to make more money, I'm going to need to learn another language, for instance.
Okay. We've still got people on the line. Next caller? Thank you very much. We will. Next caller, please give us your name and state your question quickly for Dr. Collins. We're running low on time.
My name is Dominic. Yeah, I'm considered white. My wife of 30 years is considered black. But I don't see anything culturally different between us of any importance that matters in my life.
Okay.
We'd like everyone to come to arrive at that pinnacle of understanding.
Yeah, that's great. Do you have a question?
I think it's reality.
Okay.
Okay.
Excellent, Dominic. Thank you so much. We have time for one more caller, if you'll give us your name and state your question for Dr. Collins.
Yes, my name is Shahida, and thank you so much. I really enjoyed listening to the station.
Could you turn your radio down, Shahida?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much. Come back to the phone now. Please come back to the phone, Shahida. Oh, well.
Hello?
Yes, I'm sorry.
All right.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Yeah. My question is, how do you think the connection between multiculturalism and youth culture may enact or not privilege in this society?
I think that with the emergence, with the dominance of hip-hop culture is popular culture basically today, with you know a few exceptions. I mean, it's influenced everything even beyond hip-hop. I mean, it's influenced everything from NASCAR racing to movies.
It's
to
global.
It's everywhere. And so in that sense, those of us who are from the hip-hop generation, those of us who were born essentially after I was born, I'm at the upper end of what's considered a hip-hop generation, so early 70s, should have at least a more complex, more multicultural view of the world anyway. And those even born, say, since the mid-1980s, they're completely engrossed in this culture. And so there is some promise, there are some signs that as those generations age and come to power and come to positions of power throughout society, that the world of race in America could be a better place. But there are, you know, but you have to deal with the issue. There's the issue of authenticity that comes with that too, which is what is authentic blackness? What's authentic in hip hop that people want to take away from it and do something in terms of social justice with it?
Well, thank you. This has been a dialogue with Dorothy and Richard Healy. We've been listening to Donald Earl Collins, author of Fear of a Black America. You can get that on the internet. You can get it at Politics and Prose. And we encourage you, don't just read about it, live it. Live life outside the box. Thank you so much. We're going out with Fear of a Mixed Planet from Shock G from Digital Underground.
Is that your boyfriend or your brother? You look more like your lover than your mother. Dead on each other. Don't they make a good couple? A body couple's way happy at the fact that they're making DNA copies. Dead on each other's lips. Dead on each other's nose.
The baby got 10 toes.
WPFW, Washington.
You're
You're listening to Pacifica Headline News. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Here's what's happening in the news. The forced evacuation of Gaza settlements have begun. 14,000 police have entered to remove several thousand residents and protesters. Four of the non-